Coming up on AEA Amplified, it's Shop Talk with AirSense Avionics President Brian Yablon.
From the Aircraft Electronics Association, this is AEA Amplified, a podcast for aviation's technology experts, with your host, Jeff Hill.
Hello, aviation friends. Welcome back to another episode of AEA Amplified, sponsored by Avionics News, the AEA's monthly magazine, available in print, online, and mobile apps for iOS and Android devices. I'm your host, Jeff Hill, and today is March 27th, 2024. We are just coming off a very successful AEA convention in Dallas that took place last week, and it had a little over 1,700 avionics professionals in attendance, very good attendance there for 4 days of training. And one of those shop owners in attendance was Brian Yablon. He is the founder and president of AirSense Avionics, which is located in Scappoose, Oregon. And we're going to do something just a little bit differently today with Shop Talk. We also have with us Rick Perry, who is the AEA Vice President of Government and Industry Affairs. And in just a few minutes, we're going to ask Brian. He has several regulatory type questions that a lot of shop owners, avionics technicians, avionics professionals want to know. They're commonly asked, and it's just great information to share. And so we just thought we would invite Brian on to ask the AEA and ask Rick directly some of those questions to help spread the word on that. But before we do that, Brian, let me first give you a chance to just introduce yourself and tell your story a little bit for our Amplified listeners and our audience. I know you founded the shop there in Oregon just a few years ago, but tell us a little bit about your career path that led into that. What led you to start your shop, which I believe you did back in 2018?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, and it's great to be here. I came about aviation maintenance in a sort of backdoor fashion. I'm actually an electrical engineer, worked for a Fortune 100 company doing engineering design and management for most of my 30-year career. And I've been a pilot ever since the 80s and purchased an airplane, my first airplane that I purchased back in 2011. I come from a flying family, and so it was just a natural sort of thing for me to get into flying, and have really enjoyed it. I'm pretty handy with the engineering background, and so I tended to do quite a bit of the maintenance on my own aircraft myself, with the assistance of a maintenance shop owner in the area, who I became, you know, quite friendly with. And one day I was working on my airplane, you know, wrenching something and whistling, and the shop owner came by and he said, hey, you really enjoy this? I said, yeah, I love this stuff. And he said, well, I can use some help around here. At the time, I had retired from my day job, and I started helping around his shop, you know, just odd hours here and there, building a flap or, you know, doing some work, helping with an annual, any kind of maintenance tasks he had in the shop. I started showing up more and more to help him out, and just naturally gravitated towards avionics because of my electrical background. And it wasn't before too long that I asked him, why don't you have a dealership, a Garmin dealer, Avidyne, you know, PS Engineering, whatever. And he didn't want to become a repair station. He just didn't want to deal with the FAA background. And with a career in, you know, Fortune 100 companies, I thought I knew a thing or two about bureaucracy. And so I said, well, I'll go and become a repair station. How hard can it be? And it was a daunting task. I didn't know anything about it. I Googled repair station, found AEA's link, and realized that there was a class coming up in Lee's Summit for repair station training. This guy named Rick Perry, who's you know, leading the class, and so I enrolled, and I showed up for a week of drinking out of a fire hose and learning everything about repair stations and how to go about setting myself up as one. And that was the beginning of a journey. It took me about 3 years of working with the FAA before I could finally get my certification. We started back in December of 2017, and in December of 2020, I got my air agency certificate, and we opened the doors right away and started working on airplanes. And this became my new career, and I've been loving it ever since. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's great to hear the outcome and the success story of the class you're referring to is called the Certified Repair Station Training Course. That, yes, it is taught by Rick. It's a 5-day course, and it's wonderful to hear. That class kind of incubates startup Part 145 repair stations, and so you're one of those, and that's awesome to hear. Anybody who's interested in taking that course can find out more about that at aea.net/training. So, what I'm going to do at this point, is let you guys have shop talk and let Brian ask some really good questions, and we've got Rick Perry on the line, and he's going to answer them. So, Brian, take it away.
Okay, Rick, you and I have spoken many, many times over the past years with all sorts of regulatory questions that I've had, and you've always been a tremendous resource in getting them answered and helping steer me on the right path. And that's one of the great benefits of AEA membership. I just want to put a plug in for our organization, is that Rick says he works for us, and he certainly does. He's always available to me when I need help trying to get myself out of a jam. And so just reflecting back on some of the questions that I've had, a few months ago, I had an individual come to me with his Piper Cherokee. He had a couple of antique Narco comm radios in it, and he was preparing the airplane to flip it so that he could move on to his next project. And he wanted to replace the Narco and something else in there with a pair of Garmin GTR 200Bs. That radio is not a standard offering for the certificated aircraft by Garmin. They at the time were really trying to push the GTR 225. But the 200B was available for experimental aircraft, and there was a PMA version of that that was available for installation in certificated aircraft, and that's what the owner asked me to install. And so I went ahead and I did it, and I signed it off as a minor because I was replacing two existing comm radios with two new comm radios. And then I had an interesting discussion with someone at Garmin. I called Garmin support for an unrelated issue, and it came up that I had installed a 200B in an aircraft. And he said, "Oh, well, you installed the." He started asking questions about the G3X system that's in that aircraft. I'm like, "Well, there is no G3X. This is an old Cherokee." He said, "Oh, well, you installed the radio illegally." I'm like, "Well, what are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, the 200B is actually only approved for installation as part of the G3X STC. It's not approved for installation by itself, and you don't have approved data to install it, so you can't do that." And I figured, well, it's a minor, it's a radio. I don't really understand why this would be problematic. So tell me, Rick, did I break the law?
Well, so I'll start off with my standard disclaimer. I never discuss law. I only discuss regulations. I leave the law to the lawyers. Your scenario has actually three elements to it, and each of the elements has to be answered in its own right. So let's start with a basic Narco comm being replaced with another comm radio. Okay, is that major or minor alteration? Brian, as you know, you call me and go, "Hey, is this major or minor?" And I go, "I don't know. What did your analysis tell you?" Because, in fact, we have a guide for classifying alterations. And each aircraft is unique. Each aircraft has its own configuration, and so each aircraft has to be evaluated. A couple of years ago, we worked with ASTM, and we have a standard F3361, which is a standard guide for classifying alterations for in-service aircraft under the FAA authority. As you know, as part of your AEA membership, you have full access to the ASTM aviation standards. And so the first element is that you have to go through the checklist that's at the back of this standard to determine whether or not it's major or minor. I will tell you that, comm radio for comm radio generally is pretty hard pressed to trigger major, but the modification to the panel, the modification to the antennas, those types of things certainly could trigger it. So whether it's major or minor depends on the aircraft and the installation itself. So that's a little more difficult to answer. The second element to your question is whether or not a PMA'd article, in this case the radio, the GTR-200B, whether or not that is an approved radio. And the element with PMA and TSO, we're familiar with both of those. TSO is a general approval, a design approval by the FAA. The TSOA is actually their approval for production. And the TSO meets the standards necessary to be a broad-based radio. And so doing a radio for radio replacement, typically we would use TSO. In this particular case, you have a PMA. And without knowing the applicability of the PMA, so you have to go and you have to go look at the applicability of the PMA itself and to see whether or not that PMA is in fact directly linked to the G3X or whether or not it's a broad-based PMA. Without going into the actual PMA documentation, I can't tell you that one off the top of my head. But then that leads to the third element to this, and that is that do we have to have approved radios in the aircraft? And generally speaking, the answer is we prefer that for a number of reasons. But when you actually go into Part 91205, there is no prescriptive language that says that we're only allowed to use approved radios. All radios have to be approved by the FCC for broadcast purposes, and they have to meet the FCC requirements for aviation frequencies. But whether or not it has to have TSO or PMA is an area of debate. The challenge of not using that is that the installer becomes responsible to make sure that the radio, in fact, is applicable and appropriate and meets the design and certification standards of the aircraft for the intended purpose. And so it's a complicated answer, I guess, and kind of a long way around it. But you know, the one comment you said when you were talking to the technician that you didn't have approved data, therefore it was and you know, his words, I guess, illegal installation. I always kind of chuckle at those because, to your point, if it is a minor alteration, I only have to have acceptable data, and whether or not that data is, you know, available and appropriate for the installation purposes and the configuration purposes, previously approved data that is applicable and appropriate is acceptable data, and that coupled with the installation instructions under AC 4313 certainly seems like a reasonable installation to me.
Okay, well, that's reassuring, because actually I did go through the ASTM document. That's our shop standard procedure to look at F3361 to make those determinations. And like you said before, the FAA gives the AMP or the repair station considerable latitude in making the determination about whether something is a major or a minor alteration. It's really nice to have a job aid that steers us in the right direction. And that's collateral that I can always pull out and show my inspector if this thing ever comes up for a question. But yeah, that's gratifying, I guess. I've got another kind of follow-on question. I had a an individual with an airplane come to me who wanted me to install a used but serviceable old GNS 430. I don't recall whether it was a 430 WAS or not, but back in the days when those 430s were being produced by Garmin, there really weren't any SDCs available for doing the installation. I think that, of course, I wasn't in the industry at that point, so I don't have much context, but I'm under the impression that these required a field approval on pretty much on a per installation basis, but that those field approvals were easy to get because everybody was installing GNS 430s at the time, and it was a well understood and fairly easy installation. Is my understanding though now is that field approvals are much more difficult to get. I've never gotten a field approval from the FISDO. I have received field approvals from designated airworthiness representatives, but not from from the FISDO. And so, first of all, let me back up. Is it possible to install a GNS 430 just like I did the GTR 200B and say, well, it's a minor. I'm taking out a NAVCOM. I'm putting in a NAVCOM GPS. It's a navigator with another navigator. There's a radio. You know, what's the big deal? It's a minor. If you go through 3361, it seems like it would be permitted, except there's this little footnote in there about you have to notify the FAA when you install a GPS in an airplane. What's that all about?
So, yeah, you're on the right track there. So the 430, when the STC was done for the 430, it was a single STC. And the industry did follow-on field approvals for the 430-530 line. When the 430 was upgraded to the 430W and the 530 was upgraded to the 530W, that was one of the very first applications of an AML STC, an approved model list STC. So when you do those, the major minor does kick in. Now, the element back in the day, there was the 430 GPS and the 430 was a new and novel product. And as such, there in fact was a policy that said GPS had to be initially approved by STC and that all installations had to be field approved. And that has kind of continued on, although I have not seen that policy in a very long time. AC20-138, I believe, does allow for GPS installed for VFR purposes to be a minor alteration. And it's placarded that it's not for IFR flight. But in order to verify and validate the GPS for IFR usage, we typically would do that and document that on a 337. And that's where we get into that field approval, if you will. The interesting part of that is there's never been an actual good application of the 337 because you're not really getting data approval. You're simply using the 337 to document that you did an IFR verification flight and check the performance of the GPS for IFR purposes. And then when you start coupling that into autopilots and things like that, it becomes a little bit more complicated. And so for the most part, if I'm installing a GPS for IFR purposes, we do default to the field approval for that reason. And so if it's an IFR GPS, generally it would be a field approval. If it is a VFR GPS, it would not.
Okay, and how does one go about getting that field approval from the FISDO these days?
Just as you did. You used a designee, a DAR, to do that. The FAA's workload and their familiarity with our technologies have just really challenged the FAA employee field approval. There's still a few inspectors out there that will do it that are staggered throughout the country. But as a general rule, the local FAA offices have not done field approvals for quite some time.
Okay. So obviously, one of the big differences between getting a designated airworthiness representative to do a field approval is there's a fee. These are trained individuals who are going to charge you for their time, sometimes considerably. And those are probably things you want to discuss with the aircraft owner before embarking on that installation. In my case, big confession here, that was a big whoopsie for me. I didn't realize until we were knee deep in the installation that, wait, this is not going to work. And I kind of went to my DAR hat in hand, mea culpa on a weekend, and the sign-off was happening. The guy had a ferry pilot coming out to get his airplane, and we managed to save it. But I ended up eating the cost for that. So I would recommend to any of our listeners who are contemplating something similar that they get their ducks in a row with their DAR first. And then understand what the fee structure will be so that the owner can be appropriately apprised. In the end, I think considering the cost of the 430 itself plus the approval, that would have steered that owner to something a little more modern with an STC, to instead of that old antique radio. So
Well,
in your answer, Rick, you mentioned,
but
oh, go
before
ahead.
you, yeah, before you go too far though, understand that, the field approval had a bit of a misunderstanding to begin with. And that is that somehow the field approval was free. Typically when we went to the FISDO back in the day, now we go back 25, 30 years, and it wasn't unusual that we'd have a stack of field approvals for the inspector to sign when they came out to the shop. But, in the last probably, 20 years anyway, it was not unusual to spend 4 to 8 hours processing the field approval, which is your time and effort on the job. And it was not unusual at all for the shops not to be charging for their time in getting this because the FAA didn't charge the shop, therefore the customers, well, it must be free, therefore why are you charging me, right? And I think that's a real misnomer about a field approval. The DAR field approval is for the vast majority of Part 23 avionics systems is truly the preferred method. When you start getting into more complex systems, you would use a DER to do that. But if it's a follow-on field approval, the DAR is a much better choice and quite a bit cheaper than hiring two or three different DERs to develop the data. But what's nice about it is an amortized cost that does get passed on to the customer in a much cleaner method than simply billing them for the hours it takes to process a field approval.
Yeah, excellent point. I no longer, when I started this business, I was somewhat naive, and all the time that I spent signing off these jobs at the end of the jobs was, that was my time. But now we're routinely adding 3 or 4 hours to every bid in an effort to recoup some of that. And to be honest, I've never had an owner balk at it. They understand that this stuff is complicated, and repair stations in particular have reporting requirements that are a little bit different than what your average IA would have. So yeah, we charge for our time now.
Right.
I was going to ask you before, you mentioned STC and AML STC, and I wanted to ask, what is the difference? What is the practical difference between those two, and how does it affect me and an airplane owner?
So the short answer is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. An STC is an STC is an STC. There are arguably three different types of STCs, and it's about the applicability, not about the STC. So what you're talking about as an STC is generally a single serial number one-off STC. And that's where you have an airplane in shop. You go and do an installation based on that aircraft's configuration and that aircraft's design. And the STC is for that airplane. And if you go back to your 430 question, that is actually how the original 430 was approved, was a one-off STC. And if I remember right, it was a Cherokee 6. And then you'll have what's called a multi-model STC. And a multi-model STC is generally those models of an aircraft that would be on a type certificate data sheet. So if you look at, for instance, the type certificate data sheet for a Cessna 172, it's mostly it's 172 to, I'm not even sure, I think we're at V now. And so you would have a multi-model list that would include all of those. Or you might have a multi-model list that would include most of the 100 series Cessnas, okay? But it's a very limited applicability, and it's a commonality between that. Because of the sheer volume of field approvals, when we did the 430, 530, the FAA was losing control, if you will, of the follow-on installations. And so they needed to create this mechanism that allowed for a little bit higher level of certitude, but yet not all the way into the STC. And so when you look at an STC or a multi-model STC, you actually have to open up the STC to amend the applicability list. Whereas with an approved model list, you're allowed to open up the applicability list and the installation manual independent of the STC. And where that comes in is when you take a legacy STC that, say, it's 10 years old, well, a lot of the reference documents are TCA documents or SAE documents or ASTM documents may have been revised during that 10-year period. And so when a manufacturer or an STC holder would go in to add a new aircraft to the list, they would have to update the STC to the latest revision level of all this, the supplemental documentation as well. The AML STC doesn't require that. And so the STC itself can remain static while the applicability list and the installation instructions for that applicability list can remain dynamic. And so that's really the only difference between them. The STC is still an STC, and you can still do a follow-on installation to an AML STC for aircraft that aren't on the applicability list. And if it's a minor alteration, you can use it as acceptable data, as you did with the original 200B installation you were talking about.
Okay, real quick follow-up question. How hard is it for a manufacturer to amend the AML STC if they get a request from a shop to do it? For instance, you know, if I've got some radio that the AML is as long as my arm, it's every model out there except for this one weirdo airplane that, you know, there's only three left and I want to put it in there. In order for me to do it, because I've determined it's a major, I've got to see my DAR. But gosh darn, you know, we should just be able to do it, because if it works in every other airplane, right. Is there a way to sort of backdoor that, or no, it's the DAR route?
Well, so from a manufacturer's perspective, when they choose to go down the route of an AML, part of the certification plan for that STC includes amending the applicability list. But there's no free lunch. It's an expensive process for the manufacturers. And so when you have a one-off, or for instance, I routinely get calls where somebody will have a Warbird or some other aircraft that truly isn't on the AML, but they want this equipment installed, a follow-on field approval is truly the best option for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, that's all the questions I have for you, Rick, this time. And I know I'll be calling you next week with something else. So thank you very much for clarifying and advising and guiding.
Not a problem. I'm happy to help. And as you said, you know, I'm a phone call away when you need me. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jeff and let you close it out, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Thank you, Rip. That is Shop Talk. And as I mentioned, this is the first installment of this edition. So, Brian, we're going to invite you back on for future episodes of the Amplified Podcast because you have a lot of great questions that, again, are so helpful for other shop owners, AEA members to know. Many of them have the same questions that you do. And so this is a great format to just sit around and talk shop. So thank you to Brian Yablon. He is the founder and president of AirSense Avionics, which is located in Scappoose, Oregon. And thank you again to Rick Perry for being with us as well to answer those questions. Folks, we do have several upcoming avionics training courses over the next several months that are scheduled here at AEA headquarters in Lee's Summit, Missouri. And those class sizes are small, so seating is limited. You'll want to check out the course schedule and enroll today for those courses that are of interest to you at aea.net/training. And also for AEA members out there, be sure to save the dates for the upcoming AEA regionals that will take place later this year. Registration and hotel information will be available soon, and you can find all of that out at aea.net/regionals. And finally, of course, don't forget about the jobs board. It's got lots of career opportunities available at locations throughout the country. You can explore where you might land at your next job at aea.net/jobs. And that's going to wrap it up for today. We hope you can join us again soon for another episode of AEA Amplified, sponsored by Avionics News, the AEA's monthly magazine available in print, online, and mobile apps for iOS and Android devices. You can check it out at avionicsnews.net. Thanks again to Brian Ablon and Rick Perry for Shop Talk today. And until next time, for our producer-engineer Aaron Ward, this is your host, Jeff Hill, wishing you blue skies ahead. So long, everybody.